Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Dr. Samuel Gregg, Director of Research at the Acton Institute, where he specializes extensively in political economy, economic history, ethics and finance, and natural law theory. He has an MA in political philosophy from the University of Melbourne and a Doctor of Philosophy degree in moral philosophy and political economy from the University of Oxford. Dr. Gregg has authored several books, including Morality, Law, and Public Policy, Economic Thinking for the Theologically Minded, On Ordered Liberty, The Commercial Society, The Modern Papacy, and Tea Party Catholic, The Catholic Case for Limited Government, a Free Economy, and Human Flourishing, to name just a few of the books he has written. We will link to those books and other resources on our website, and for those of you who are multilingual, you will be pleased to find that several of these works have been translated into a variety of languages. Beyond books, Sam has published in journals such as the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy, Journal of Markets and Morality, Economic Affairs, Notre Dame Journal of Law, Ethics and Public Policy, Foreign Affairs, and Policy. He's a regular writer of opinion pieces, which appear in publications such as the Wall Street Journal Europe, Public Discourse, American Spectator, and Business Review Weekly. Again, just to name a few, we have a prolific writer and thinker on our show today, and I want to welcome Sam. Welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you. It's very good to be with you. I'm looking forward to a good discussion.
Yeah, I am too. You've got some really fascinating stuff here that people don't really look into. And you recently penned an article for the Independent Review, which was part of a six-article symposium on Pope Francis and economics. And it's a really good compilation of papers that covered a number of really great topics, including environmental conservation, charitable giving, and a few other topics. We'll link to that as well on our website so people can check out the entire volume. Your article was entitled Understanding Pope Francis, Argentina, Economic Failure, and the Teología del Pueblo. And it gives a really good background on Jorge Bergoglio, who became Pope Francis, and his historical concept of his upbringing, and you argue that this upbringing had a huge influence on his economic thinking. So this is great stuff here. But before we do that, I want to ask a question that I've had a few other times before. Obviously, Jorge Bergoglio changed his name to Pope Francis when he became Pope. I've always wondered this, as not being a Catholic, but does he still sign his name Bergoglio on personal checks, and does he have a credit card that says Bergoglio, or does he have an American Express card that says Pope Francis?
I don't think he has a credit card at all. I don't think he has anything like that. I mean, there's stories about when he was the Archbishop of Buenos Aires, and even more so when he was provincial of the Jesuits in Argentina, that he lived a very simple life. Austerity was the watchword, so to speak. So in that sense, I think he has remained very, very detached from, let's call it, the things of this world, but even more so when it comes to the world of, let's say, money and finance.
Yeah, and it's interesting that he's writing on these topics and thinking broadly about them. For me, I think you gotta have a credit card and go into debt every so often to understand finance a little bit better. But we'll see what Pope Francis is thinking about. So over the tenure of Francis's papacy, and I think we're about 4 years into his papacy now.
Yes, the fourth year will be in March next year. So. You know, that's not a short period of time.
Yeah, especially for popes. So this is a fairly extensive period of time. He's written two big encyclicals that were released pertaining to economics in some form or another. And those are, and you're going to have to help me in pronouncing this Latin here, Evangelia Gaudium and Laud-
Evangelii Gaudium, which is an apostolic exhortation.
Okay.
And Laudato Si, which was an encyclical.
Okay, Laudato Si. Okay, that's, wow, okay. Difficult things pronouncing these in Latin for me. First off, for those non-Catholics in the audience, what is an encyclical and exhortation? And who's this supposed to be addressed to? How is this done?
Well, encyclicals, as the word implies, is a type of letter that is literally circulated for the bishops of the Catholic Church. Pope Francis, of course, his authority of Pope comes from his position as the Bishop of Rome. That's the core of all his authority. And when popes write an encyclical letter, it is addressed first and foremost to the bishops of the Catholic Church. So that's the first thing. Now, it's also the case that other Catholics are more than welcome to read the letter. In fact, they're often usually encouraged to do so. And an encyclical is, to put it this way, one of the highest level acts of what's called the magisterium. The magisterium is the teaching authority of the successor of Peter and the bishops who are in communion with him. So there's different levels of authority that are attached to different documents. But an encyclical is a very high level, in fact, maybe even the highest. But even within encyclicals, there are different things that are certainly binding on Catholics and many things that are not. So, for example, when the Pope discusses what are called matters of faith and morals, so these are things concerning dogmas and doctrines of the Catholic Church, when it comes to what Catholics are required to believe and how they're required to act, these things are binding insofar as it reflects what has been previously taught. So when the Pope talks about something like the Trinity or a moral question such as, let's say, abortion or any number of subjects like that, to the extent that he articulates what popes have previously taught and what the Church has previously taught, these things are binding. So popes literally can't make stuff up. They can't suddenly say, okay, you don't have to believe in the Trinity anymore. Their authority comes from teaching what has always been taught by the Catholic Church and what is held to be true. On the other hand, if they're in the document, for example, you'll often, in documents like encyclicals, say Laudato Si, you'll find, for example, observations about all sorts of subjects, ranging from climate change to plankton levels in the ocean to things like the state of the global economy. Now, when the Pope talks about those sorts of issues, Catholics are certainly obliged to pay attention to what the Pope says, but he's simply expressing in those instances a view that may or may not, depending on the evidence that exists for it, basically in those instances, Catholics are obliged to pay attention to these things, but they're not binding. So the Pope's view on why people are in poverty, well, it's a view, and Catholics need to pay attention to it, but I, as a lay Catholic, can say, well, actually, Holy Father, no, I don't think your explanation of poverty is quite right. Or when the Pope makes an observation about things that fall into the realms of the social and economic sciences, to the extent that these subjects don't touch on moral questions, it's just one view among many. So while Catholics should pay attention to that type of thing, that doesn't mean that they have to say, okay, the Pope believes that inequality is growing throughout society. Well, I could turn around and say, well, actually, there's a lot of evidence that suggests that that's not the case, that globally speaking, inequality is shrinking. Nonetheless, I need to pay attention to what the Pope says and reflect upon that and see how that impacts the way that I think about some of these complex political and economic questions that are typically addressed in what are called social encyclicals. Social encyclicals are these documents that are specifically written to focus on social, political, and economic issues. And they really began back in 1891 when Rerum Novarum, which is maybe the most famous of all social encyclicals, was published by Pope Leo XIII.
You want to talk a little bit about the history of some of these social encyclicals, going back to Rerum Novarum in a little bit, but I still have a few questions about these. We hear a lot about papal infallibility, and I think a lot of non-Catholics toss this term around by saying, well, you know, whatever the Pope says is a direct pipeline from God, and you can never question it. What? How really does papal infallibility play into these encyclicals, if at all?
Well, they do play into these encyclicals insofar as when the Pope speaks about a matter of faith and morals, to the extent that he is articulating what the Church has always taught, say, on questions of sexual morality or dogmas like the nature of the Eucharist, etc., or even the nature of the Church, then to the extent that he echoes what has been taught in the past, that's an exercise of what's called the ordinary magisterium. And there's infallibility is attached to that in as much as he's articulating what has been taught before. On the other hand, if the Pope looks out the window and says, it's snowing, and it's not, then no Catholic is obliged to say, well, I guess it really is snowing, despite the fact that there's no evidence that that's the case. Or even when the Pope makes an observation about, say, economic trends in a given society or even around the globe, that, as I said before, really an expression of a view, an opinion, but it's not infallible. So I myself, for example, have criticized some of the things that the Pope has said about economic issues, primarily, I think, because some of the things that he said on these regards are empirically very difficult prove, but I'm not. That doesn't involve me questioning any aspect of church authority or calling into question the authority of the Pope, because when the Pope talks about something like, I don't know, economics or what's happening in the world or the economy, be it in the country or Europe or globally or wherever, there's no exercise of infallibility involved. The Pope himself would say to you that there's no exercise of infallibility involved in these.
Okay, we've already teased two of the encyclicals that Pope Francis has written. Give us, just to set the table, give us a little bit of flavor of what these two things are, and then we'll back it up and do a little bit of the history of things. There's Evangelii Gaudium and Laudato Si. I'm probably pronouncing it
wrong. Evangelii Gaudium appeared at the end of 2013, which is the first year of Francis' pontificate, and it outlined, more or less, his agenda for his pontificate. And this is where you find things where he talks about the need for the Church to go to what he calls the peripheries of society, by which he means those people who are alienated from the Church or who disagree with the Church about different things or who are living lives that are clearly not in accordance with Christian teaching or people who have never heard of Christ, etc. So most of that apostolic letter is about the Church evangelizing the world and how the Church evangelizes the world and what the Church needs to emphasize when it evangelizes the world. There's very little in that document that has to do, for example, with economics, although there is six paragraphs in that very, very long text that does touch explicitly on economic issues. Again, not invoking infallibility or anything like that, or claiming that those paragraphs have some sort of authority that they don't. But there are quite a few people, like myself, who took issue with those six paragraphs by saying that there were some things here that didn't match up with the empirical evidence about questions of poverty, or even the way that he characterized the economic development of the world over the past few years. There were quite a few people, Catholic and non-Catholic, who took issue with that. When it comes to Laudato Si, Laudato Si is an encyclical that is explicitly addressed to the question of the environment. And it talks quite a bit about climate change, although not as much as some people think. It also spends quite a lot of time explicating a Christian theology of how one ought to think about the environment. It also addresses a range of questions ranging from the relationship between population and the world's resources. There's a fair amount of historical analysis and historical claims that are made there about how environmental degradation has occurred, and there's all sorts of suggestions offered for how we might be able to deal with some of the environmental problems that the Pope believes much of the globe faces. So these documents are quite different. The first one, Evangelii Gaudium, is very much a document about the Pope's agenda for how the Church carries out its mission. Laudato Si is a social encyclical, and therefore it is explicitly concerned with social, political, and economic questions. And in the case of this encyclical, it's very focused upon environmental questions.
So here's a general question, and you could apply this to Pope Francis in specific, but for popes write a lot of encyclicals over the years. Different popes do that. What possesses them to address non-religious issues? You would think that in our modern specialized world, hey, you guys stick to the theology, leave the climate change up to the meteorologist folks. What possesses them to write about these things?
Well, a number of things. I suppose the best way of thinking about it is that the Pope in fact, all popes, when they're writing about these types of issues, they rarely propose a concrete approach for how we ought to deal with any number of questions. What they tend to do in social encyclicals is outline the principles of Catholic social teaching, what's called Catholic social teaching, that need to be brought to bear upon a given situation, and then they show how these principles might be brought to bear upon a given economic, political, or social situation. The point is to provide guidance based upon revelation, church tradition, the natural law, for Catholics and other people who are interested in these issues as they seek to wrestle with some very complex matters ranging from questions of poverty to issues of the environment. So it's not as if the Pope is trying to supplant the role of social scientists or economists or political scientists, etc., etc. He and his successors are not trying to supplant that role. All they're doing, for the most part, is offering the principles of Catholic social teaching and showing how they can be applied to any number of different questions. Sometimes it's the case that these social encyclicals are produced in light of a specific crisis or problem. So, for example, Rerum Novarum, which appeared in 1891, that is clearly Leo XIII saying, we now live in a world created by the Industrial Revolution. This is different to the world that existed before the Industrial Revolution. Therefore, we need to think about how the Church's moral teaching ought to inform the behavior and actions of Catholics in this new world. It's the same, for example, with Quadragesimo Anno, which was a 1931 social encyclical produced by Pius XI. That encyclical is very much written in the conditions of the Great Depression. And the point of that is to provide guidance to Catholics about how they deal with this Great Depression. Centesimus Annus, which came out in 1991, that is clearly addressed to Catholics in light of the collapse of communism. So in that sense, these social encyclicals, they're not trying to take over the role of lay Catholics and other people as we try and address these different questions. They are primarily designed to provide principles and guidelines and parameters for thinking through these questions through the eyes of Christ.
Okay. And you hit upon the next question I was going to have, was to talk about the background of these social encyclicals. You went back to Rerum Novarum with Pope Leo XIII saying, okay, we're in industrial capitalism now. There's workers concentrated in cities, and this is causing some new social issues, so let's think about this. Are there any general strands of thought that run through these social encyclicals specifically related to economic issues that date back to them, or has there been change over time? Obviously, there's change in between the 1890s and what Pope Leo XIII is seeing and what Pope John Paul II is seeing in the collapse of communism, but can we garner any kind of commonalities in some of these encyclicals?
Yes, the encyclicals focus upon, as I mentioned, principles. These principles don't change. The primary principles are the dignity of the human person, that every person has an intrinsic dignity by virtue of being made in the image and likeness of God, and therefore they have rights and responsibilities. It also, another principle is the principle of solidarity, which is just another way of saying we need to love our neighbor. There's the principle of what's called subsidiarity, which is heavily focused upon the importance of human freedom. There's also the principle of what's called the universal destination of material goods. And all that means is that the goods of the world that we have now and in the future are meant for the use of all people, and that we have to work out how we use these goods in ways that are fair and equitable. And one of the ways in which the church has always talked about that is through the institution of private property, which the church has always said is not absolute. Goods like human life are more important than things, so therefore private property is not absolute. But the church has always said that private property is very, very important when it comes to ordering society. Another principle is that the state does have a role in society, but it's a limited role. And then there's a notion which I think many of your listeners have probably heard of, which is the common good. And the common good is not some sort of code word for socialism or socialization. All it means is that the common good is what are the conditions that allow each individual and community to flourish. So these principles, you'll find them all through the encyclicals of Catholic social teaching. Now, but there are differences between the encyclicals, and many of those differences are driven by the fact that popes are writing at different points of time. In 1891, when Rerum Novarum appears, the church is clearly grappling with the reality of the Industrial Revolution, and it had to do so because suddenly this world, which had been highly agricultural, was now becoming industrial, and this had implications for Catholics and political life, but also just how the church lived out its life, because once upon a time, most people lived in agricultural areas. Now they're moving into urban areas. That presents new challenges for the church as it seeks to evangelize people and keep them in the church. Then 40 years later, we have the encyclical Quadragesimal Anno, 1931. That simply means 40 years, the 40th anniversary of Rerum Novarum. And this encyclical reiterates the principles that I just mentioned, and then applies them to a new and different set of circumstances, which, of course, is the Great Depression. Then we go forward to Vatican II, and the social document of Vatican II, the Second Vatican Council, is called Gaudium et Spes. That means joy and hope. And what that does is apply and outline the principles of Catholic social teaching, and then look at them in light of things that have happened since Quadragesimo Anno. And so you have the rise of the welfare state, you've had the Second World War, you've got communism, et cetera, et cetera. Then you go forward through some of the social encyclicals that Pope John Paul II produced. He wrote three social encyclicals. One was called Laborum Exercens, which was a reflection upon the nature of human work. Then you had Solicitudo Res Socialis, which is a document which focuses very much upon international development. And then you have Cinquesimus Annos, which simply means 100 years, the 100th anniversary of Rerum Novarum, which is very heavily influenced by the fact that communism has collapsed in Eastern Europe and is about to collapse in the Soviet Union, and the church needs to rethink what's called the social question, or how Catholics live in light of these new economic realities, and yet continue to follow the same principles. So that is more or less what Catholic social teaching is. It's a way of trying to show Catholics how they can shape society in ways that accord with the demands of the gospel and natural law, despite the fact that the circumstances that they live in are constantly changing.
It's a really great summary of those documents and how these things change over time but still stay relatively similar. You said something that was very interesting, is that this is how the Catholic Church or Catholics should shape their environment. But one of the things that I love about your article in the Independent Review is that you acknowledge implicitly, if not explicitly, that the thinking of various popes on topics is really influenced by their own socioeconomic historical context. So while right. Catholics try to influence history, history influenced Catholics. And Pope Francis is the first pope from outside of Europe, albeit in a very European-flavored Latin American country, Argentina. But he's a little bit of an outsider here, and Argentina has a huge formative impact on him. So before we dive into the history of Pope Francis and how Argentina affected him, people probably need to know a little bit about Argentina. So give us a, I don't know, roughly a century history of Argentina in a few minutes.
Well, Argentina, the best way of describing it, frankly, is that it is the 20th century's example of how a once wealthy, relatively politically stable country moved over a period of decades to being a country profoundly characterized by political instability and economic decline. You know, most countries go from poorer situations to wealthier situations. Argentina is the example of the 20th century country that went in the opposite direction. So in 1900, for example, Argentina was per capita, GDP capita, one of the 10 wealthiest countries in the world. Even in Australia, the comparisons are often drawn between them. Today, Argentina is not in the top 10 countries in the world when it comes to per capita GDP. It's one of the most corrupt countries in the world. Its GDP has fluctuated wildly over the past 40 years. It's endured populist governments, et cetera, et cetera. It has a high level of poverty, particularly in urban areas. And the contrast with Australia is remarkable because Australia was also one of the top wealthiest countries in the world, and it still is. And many people said, well, what happened to Argentina? Why did it go down this path? And I think the answer is pretty simple, particularly when you look at the Australia comparison, because you think about both these countries. They're both large. They both have lots of natural resources, overwhelmingly European immigrant populations, a long history of American and British investment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So people say, well, what is the difference? Why is one poor and having a lot of problems, and why is one rich and relatively stable? And I think the answer is institutions. Institutions. One country has chosen to walk away over time from institutions that lead to prosperity, such as private property, rule of law, and limited government, and the other country more or less maintains an adherence to those very, very basic principles. So since 1946, Argentina has had a variety of different forms of government, most of which I think are best described as populist and peronist. And by populist, I mean governments that are driven to more or less do whatever they think it takes to get the votes and support of people. And by peronist, I'm talking about the way that a particular Argentine figure, who's probably most known because of the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical Evita, Juan Perón, who exercised a tremendous influence in terms of shifting Argentina away from these more stable foundations and much more towards what I would call a more or less a populist form of economics and populist form of government. And Argentina is still paying the price for this today, despite the fact that Perón himself died in the early 1970s.
Give us a little flavor of what Perónism or Peronismo is.
Well, Peronism is a little hard to pin down because Perón himself was remarkably good at avoiding any set of principles. In fact, over time, he adopted a range of different positions at different points of his political career. Sometimes he was seemed to be in favor of capitalism, other times he was not. Sometimes he seemed to be very much in favor of a type of democratization of society, and other times he exercised a high degree of authoritarianism. There's left-wing forms of Peronism, there's right-wing forms of Peronism. But I think there's some basic characteristics you can identify with this. One is that Peronism has always been reliant on what you might call charismatic leaders, people like Perón himself or people like Cristina Kirchner, who was until recently the president of Argentina. But if you look at the leaders that are associated with Peronism, there's this cult of personality, very strong emphasis upon the leader. Secondly, Peronist movements have typically tried to appeal to what's called the people against the interests of the elites. And by the people, they mean people from working-class backgrounds and lower middle-class backgrounds. Oh, the latter is the group, by the way, that Pope Francis comes from. So this Peronism means a hostile view of employers, the financial sector, as well as those who are perceived to be adhering to what you might call liberal constitutional arrangements. So to this extent, I think Peronism heavily relies upon an us versus them rationale, workers against the middle class, Argentines against foreigners, trade unions against employers, etc., etc. And another feature of Peronism, which I think is very clear, is nationalism. Nationalism of the political type and of the economic type. So one of the things that Peronists do is they're constantly talking about Argentina and Argentine nationalism, but they're also spent a lot of time implementing what you might call economic nationalist policies, which means things like state-directed industrialization, nationalization programs of different segments of the economy. And beneath the surface of all this, I think, there's a fair amount of what's called Kleinism, which is often justified by reference to what's called corporatist theory. From its very beginning, Peronism has involved creating lots and lots of supporters, large constituencies of support through disbursement of state largesse, whether it's in the form of government jobs or direct welfare payments. And I think Peronism relies very heavily upon corralling people into different groups. So you have capital, you have labor, you have students, you have business, you have all these different groups that are formally organized, and the government directly coordinates all of them. So that is, I suppose, a good way of describing what Peronism is. So on one level, it's highly confusing because Peron himself was very good at adapting to conditions and what's going on in the country. But there are these standard features of Peronism, which are very characteristic of populist political movements. But at the same time, there's some very specific things about it which make Peronism quite distinct to Argentina. In many respects, up until recently, you could say everyone in Argentina was a Peronist of some type, left-wing Peronist or right-wing Peronist. That tended to be the scope of discussion. Now, since last year, we've seen a shift away from some of this with the election of the first non-Peronist president since, I think, 2003. And Argentina at the moment is trying to move away from Peronist arrangements. How far it will be able to go, I'm not sure. But this is something that has deeply influenced Argentine culture, Argentine politics, the Argentine economy, and the church, I must say, as well, in Argentina itself.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that in a second. And I have to just mention that I spent a fair amount of time in Argentina over several years. And it's interesting when you talk about Perón to anybody on the street or in a cafe or in a cab. You get so many different flavors of who Perón was, you think it's almost a schizophrenic movement in many regards.
It is, and it depends. Perón himself cultivated ambiguity. If you read some of the writings that he penned, and there was a lot of them, he was a bit like Castro, who would give these long speeches. But he would talk about things like the need to avoid precision in what you believe. He would talk about the need not to be pinned down to any one particular position. He cultivated this air of unpredictability, and this is very characteristic of the way that Perón himself, his famous wife, Eva Perón, otherwise known as Evita, his second or third wife, who also Isabella Perón, who also became president of Argentina in the 1970s, succeeded her husband. But this sense that you keep things unpredictable, you're ambiguous, so that you allow yourself room for the maximum degree of political maneuvering. The other thing I think about Peronism, which is very important to remember, is that it has really shaped structures that exist in Argentina today when it comes to politics and to the economy. There have been attempts, particularly in the 1990s, to break away from some of that, but Peronism has deeply shaped Argentine culture in a way that I think non-Argentines don't often realize until they spend some time there.
One of the words that you use to describe the Peronista economy is corporatism, and that comes from the Latin word corpus, which talks about bodies, society as a body that functions together. The brain is supposed to work with the lungs, with the liver, et cetera, et cetera. How much of the influence of Catholic social thought has gone into corporatism, or do you say Peronism is a parallel line of thought that just originated on its own?
Well, Juan Perón himself quoted the encyclical Quadragesimo Anno on a number of occasions when he was outlining his political philosophy and political program, particularly in the late 1940s when he was a little bit more specific about what he believed and how he thought Argentina should be directed and structured. He drew upon some of these corporatist ideas, and corporatism means that society is divided up into groups or bodies, if you like. Business, unions, workers, employers, students, teachers, etc., etc., etc. And the government coordinates these groups towards a common end. So it doesn't abolish, for example, private property. But it does insist that the way you use your property is in some way directed by the corporate group that you happen to belong to. And if you look at the encyclical Quadragesimo Anno, you do see the outlines somewhat more vaguely than Perón articulated, but you do see the outlines of the type of corporate model of society and the economy being proposed by Pius XI. Now, interestingly, the Church, Catholic social teaching, has moved away from proposing or even outlining that particular model of economic and political order. But for at least 20 years, that type of thinking was very prevalent in many Catholic circles, particularly in the Latin American world and in parts of continental Western Europe. And it certainly left a type of imprint upon Peronism and the political and economic changes that Juan Perón introduced into Argentina, which in my view, and plenty of other people's view, is one of the major reasons why Argentina went from being very wealthy to being the 20th century's example of economic basket case.
Yeah. There's one other historical period in there that becomes important for our understanding of Pope Francis, and that is this period of liberalization in the 1990s, which then led to an economic crisis. Give us a little bit of flavor for that, and possibly, you know, why the liberalizations were enacted in relationship to why this corporatist Peronist philosophy was really slowing down the Argentine economy.
Well, when Perón first was kicked out of office by the military in the early 1950s, with, I should say, the support of the Catholic Church. He'd become very, very authoritarian, threatening his opponents, both in the military and in the civilian sector. And the Church was very happy to see him go, because he had, by the end of his time as president, the first time around, he'd become very hostile to the Church, because he wanted the Church to fit into his corporatist program, and the Church was resistant to that, because it took the view that, no, we are not part of the state apparatus. So the corporatism and corporatist structures, politically, economically, socially, all more or less remained in place for a very long period of time up until the early 1990s, when you had a reform effort, an effort to liberalize the economy, introduced, ironically enough, by a Peronist president, Carlos Menem, from the late 1980s onwards. And he, when he was elected to office, he was confronted with recession, hyperinflation, and he basically moved in an economic liberalization. He privatized quite a few state-owned industries. He tried to end subsidies and other forms of protectionism. he set a fixed exchange rate between the peso and the U.S. dollar. And during this period of time, the Argentine economy grew considerably. Per capita income grew by about 40%. The Argentine economy was 50% larger in 1998 than it was in 1990. But the economic liberalization program also had a lot of problems with it. One was that it actually wasn't as free market as some people supposed. So, for example, the Argentine labor market remained highly, highly regulated, which meant that it was very difficult for Argentina to address its high unemployment levels. Another thing that happened with the privatization that I talked about is that it was a shock for many people in Argentina to be charged the real price for things rather than the subsidized price. But also the privatization was highly marked by corruption scandals involving politicians, and this really destroyed the legitimacy of the privatization program in many Argentine lives. The other thing to note is that government spending did not decrease, really, as part of this program, so they kept spending the same amount of money. So while on the one hand they managed to bring inflation under control, there were all sorts of problems that were beneath the surface, which were associated with economic liberalization. And, of course, by the late 1990s, international and domestic investors were losing confidence in the ability of Argentina to pay back its debt. And as a consequence of this, loans to Argentina, investment in Argentina started to dry up, which resulted in a deep financial crisis. But in Argentina, they call it their own depression. And I think that's an accurate description because that's how bad it was, that erupted at the basically from 1998 until 2001. And this produced mass unemployment, significant social instability, a lack of confidence in the government. They went through something like 3 or 4 presidents in the space of 4 months, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And at the end of all this, a Peronist president was elected and basically went back to the old ways of doing things. So liberal economics, free market economics, has a very negative image in Argentina because of its particular experience of economic liberalization. And it's important to remember that Jorge Bergoglio, towards the end of this period from the late 1990s to the early 2000s, he's auxiliary bishop in Buenos Aires and is made Archbishop of Buenos Aires. So he sees all these things happening in Argentina, and he associates it with economic liberalization programs. And I think to a certain extent, this may explain some of his relatively negative views about capitalism and the free market.
And that is the direction that I want to go now to, and you did it so well by inserting Bergoglio in this historical framework, because he covers roughly the period from, you know, a little bit before the rise of Perón. He was born, I believe, in the late 1930s. Through present. So he's very aware of the social, economic, and political changes that are affecting Argentina during this whole period. Tell us a little bit about the man growing up in Argentina from his time in the priesthood to becoming the Archbishop of Buenos Aires.
Well, there's a lot that can be said, but I think the most important things to remember are, first of all, he comes from what's called a lower middle class background in Argentina. Now, you've been in Argentina, and you know that it's a highly class-conscious society. People know the type of background that you come from. People want to know what school you went to. They want to know what your parents did when you were growing up. They want to know what you learned at school, who your friends are, etc., etc. So that's true today in Argentina. It's a highly class-conscious society. And there's no class that's more class-conscious than what you might call the lower middle class. These are people who have risen out of a working-class background, or at least their parents did. There's always, particularly in economically troubling times, there's always the risk they might fall back into the working class. And so that's the type of background that Bergoglio comes from. His mother was a homemaker. His father was an accountant. He went to Catholic schools. He was Jesuit. He was very heavily influenced by the Jesuits. He joined the Jesuits as a relatively young man. He was never a diocesan priest. He was never a parish priest. He was a member of the Society of Jesus. So to that extent, he did not follow through in terms of the typical intellectual career that most Jesuits go through or aspire to or live out. He was very much involved in encouraging spiritual reflection, teaching in schools, conducting retreats, etc., forming young priests, forming young Jesuits as they entered the order. He also spent very, very little time outside Argentina. In fact, it's remarkable how little time he has spent outside Argentina. You could probably count in the space maybe no more than a calendar year that in total that he spent outside Argentina. Now, he, of course, traveled a little bit, like most people, but compared to most Catholic clergy, even particularly of that sort of level, people who are archbishops or who are made cardinals, they've seen a fair amount of the world. It's extraordinary just how little time he has spent outside Argentina, let alone Latin America. Now, he became provincial of the Jesuits, which means he was the head of all the Jesuits who were in Argentina for a significant period of time. And this was a very difficult time for the church, and particularly the Jesuit order in Latin America, because on the one hand, you have many who are very tied to the old way of doing things, who are attached to the Peronist way of doing things, who many of them came from military families, and you have to remember that the military played a very important role in Argentina for a very long period of time. By that I mean a political role. But the Jesuits also are confronted with the rise of liberation theology, which is theology that's heavily influenced by Marxism. And so Bergoglio, as the provincial of the Jesuits, is having to manage these tensions between older Jesuits and younger Jesuits, those who are inclined to what might be called a more nationalist line on things, those who are inclined to a more liberationist approach to issues. So he's basically in charge of the Jesuits during a very, very difficult period for the Jesuits themselves, the church in Argentina, but also Argentina itself. So he's provincial of the Jesuits, late 1960s, early 1970s. This is when Perón has come back to power. You have the rise of Marxist insurgencies in parts of Argentina. You have the military striking back against these different groups. There's a type of undeclared civil war that's going on through this period of time. The economy is plummeting. Perón is back, and it's not quite clear what line he's going to take. And then he dies, and his wife becomes president, and then she's thrown out in 1976 by the military. So this is a very difficult time for anyone to be navigating this particular period of history. Now, some things we do know. He was never a liberation theologian. We know that very clearly. He was very critical of Marxism. But at the same time, he was quite close to Peronist circles, particularly a group called the Iron Guard. And this was a group of young Catholic Peronist intellectuals who were not interested in Marxism, who rejected Marxism, but who were interested in working with the poor. And I think that explains, to a large extent, much of Bergoglio's focus upon the poor, which he talks about all the time, in his capacity of Pope today. Now, eventually, he was more or less moved out of his position as provincial of the Argentine Jesuits because there are a lot of people in the order who did not like him, both on the left, so to speak, and on the right. He seemed to be a person that encouraged a lot of polarization within his own religious order. And he ended up being sent at one point to a relatively obscure town in rural Argentina where he ended up teaching science and chemistry. And at one point he was brought back to Buenos Aires by the Archbishop of Buenos Aires. He was made an auxiliary bishop. And from that time on, had very little to do with the Jesuits, if at all. So he becomes Archbishop of Buenos Aires, late 1990s, early 2000s, and then he stays there for that whole period of time until he's elected Pope.
In terms of his formative background, is Bergoglio largely a theologian, or is he more of an administrator type of priest?
Well, he's not a theologian. He's never claimed to be a theologian. In fact, he's quite suspicious of theologians. He's, I think, generally suspicious of intellectuals. And you can see that in some of the things that he said when he was a Jesuit and when he was a provincial and when he was Archbishop of Buenos Aires. And even now, as Pope, he's quite negative in many respects about intellectuals as a whole, including theologians. As an administrator, not really, because he was a provincial of the Jesuits, and there's an administration involved in that, as there is with anyone who's a bishop or an archbishop. But I would say that his primary focus was upon spiritual formation, training people in what's called the Ignatian exercises, which is a form of Jesuit spirituality that Ignatius of Loyola, the founder of the Jesuits, came up with. And he spent a lot of time forming young people, young seminarians and priests in the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius. He also spends a fair amount of time teaching in schools, high schools. So, and again, that's not to say that he is uninterested in the life of the mind. He is interested in the life of the mind, but he's not, for example, like Benedict XVI, who is, you know, the intellectual, or for that matter, John Paul II or Paul VI, he clearly had very strong interests in the intellectual life and could rightly claim to be intellectuals themselves. So, but the other thing I'd also say is that he's never been a parish priest, so he's never been a pastor in the sense of someone who's had responsibility for a parish. He's primarily been focused upon questions of spiritual formation and, I guess, what you'd call high school education. So that's the type of way that he has exercised his ministry as a priest. And as Archbishop of Buenos Aires, again, you don't see a lot of encouragement of the intellectual life, but you do see a fair amount of work in terms of spiritual formation of clergy and lay people, but also an effort to reach out to the more marginalized sections of society in Argentina, which, as I've said a few times now, is one of the most class-conscious societies in the world. So outreach to the poor, outreach to the margins, encouraging and placing priests in suburbs of Buenos Aires that are very poor so that the poor can hear and receive the gospel as well. And again, I want to stress, there's no taint of Marxism here. There's no interest in Marxism. In fact, we know that he was very critical of Marxist versions of liberation theology. But his experiences as a priest are a little different, I'd say, from that of Benedict XVI or John Paul II.
And this all pours into something that you call the people's theology or the teología del pueblo, which has a huge impact on what he's writing in his two encyclicals that we talked about before. So give us an idea of what this Teología del Pueblo is, and also some of your concerns or critiques of this, in specific in relation to the two encyclicals that we mentioned before.
Well, the theology of the people, to use the English expression, the roots of this theology are found in the Second Vatican Council Dogmatic Constitution on the Church, which is Lumen Gentium, the light to the nations. And one of the ways that the Second Vatican Council described the Church was as the people of God, and that this is the notion that all people are called by the grace of God to salvation. Now, this was taken as an idea by a school of thought developed by three Argentine priests, especially the Jesuit Juan Carlos Scannone, who is still alive and who actually taught Greek and Latin to Bergoglio when Bergoglio was in the Jesuit formation house. Now, the thing about the theology of the people, the first thing is that it rejects Marxism. It explicitly rejects Marxist methodology and Marxist categories. A second characteristic of the theology of the people is it has a deep respect for popular piety. So veneration of local saints, public processions, localized religious arts, specific prayers that draw upon the experience and the history from which the people using the prayer emerge. In practical terms, theology of the people inspired many priests and members of religious orders to go and live and serve in the slums of Buenos Aires and many other Argentine cities. It's also never expressed hostile views of the church's teaching authority or hostile views of the magisterium or bishops and the Pope per se, which is quite different, for example, from say, liberation theology, which generally ended up having a very hostile view towards the hierarchy of the church. So that's the theology of the people. Now, here's some problems with it, I think. First of all, it takes this idea of the people as its primary reference point. But when they talk about the people, they don't mean the people of God in the way that Vatican II understood that too. It's really about the marginalized and scorned majority in Latin America. So people living on the peripheries, people living on the margins of society, which is a little different from the way that the Second Vatican Council talked about the people of God, because the people of God in that instance is used to talk about universality. All people are children of God. That's a little different from the way that theology, the people, interpreted the people. Another thing about the theology of the people is that it's very skeptical of intellectual life. It tends to be quite skeptical of what Scannone calls the enlightened elites on both the left and the right. So that's another thing. So that would include, for example, conservative intellectuals, but also Marxist intellectuals as well. But here's another problem, I think, that flows from this use of an idea of theology of people. In the first place, there's some unanswered theological questions. So when it talks about the people, it's quite different from the way the Catholic doctrine understands the people. Because the theology of the people understand the people as the poor and marginalized in the here and now. When Catholic teaching talks about the faithful, it's not just the people who are living here and now, it's also the living faithful, but also the dead faithful. And this is a group that transcends differences of material wealth, social class, and even historical period. Now, another problem, I think, is that the theology of the people is clearly influenced by Peronist thinking. Some of the people theologians, as they were called, they even wrote at length about some of what they perceived to be Christian values within Peronism. And yet, as we see, Peronism as a political movement and as a set of ideas has been a major source of Argentina's political and economic problems since the 1940s. So it seems to me that if you're influenced by a political idea and rhetoric that has inflicted enormous difficulties upon Argentina, you'd think that you'd go back and maybe rethink some of your assumptions about who the people are and the use of populist language. But the people, theologians, as they're called, haven't really done that. Another problem is that when you talk about the people, it's likely that you're going to find a lot of very different views among, quote-unquote, the people. But recognizing that sort of difference of opinion and different views, even among people who are on the margins of society, the idea of focusing upon the people tends to pretend that these differences of opinion don't exist. Another problem is that if the people are considered to be those who live on the margins of society, what does it mean for those people who are not living in this world? Those people who are, say, middle-class people, does their social and economic status somehow mean that they are not people, or they're not part of the people, or they're put in anti-people? So in other words, do those who escape poverty or who leave the slums, do they somehow cease to be part of the people? Another thing is that the theology of the people constantly talks about the will of the people and what the people want. Well, not everything that, quote-unquote, the people want is a good idea. The people might want to get rid of property rights. They might want to get rid of rule of law, things that they perceive to be constraints upon their ability to achieve a better standard of living. But the fact that the people want something doesn't mean that they should be given it, or that the idea that they're articulating makes sense in the first place. So, you can even go further and say, look, some of the ideas that are flourishing among, quote-unquote, the people, some of them are likely to be wrong. Some of them are likely to be incorrect. So not every thought, every idea that circulates on what Pope Francis often calls the peripheries of life, not every thought there is going to be reasonable or coherent. So it seems to me that there are some significant problems with the theology of the people, at least in terms of some of its underlying assumptions. Now, as I said, it's not Marxist, it's not calling for class warfare, it's very different from the liberation theologians. That said, it seems to me there are some internal problems with it that I'm not sure they've ever really resolved. But for our purposes, I think what's important is that it is clearly the dominant influence upon Pope Francis. And I think it explains some of the way he thinks, some of the things he talks about in Evangelii Gaudium and Laudato Si, and what he thinks needs to be done if one is going to tackle serious problems of economic poverty.
One of the things that you do really well in your article, and you just highlighted here, was to talk about this concept of the people or the common will or common good, which as a political or as a public choice theorist myself, when I challenge students with this to say, well, really, how do we define that? It becomes very difficult because, as you point out, the people are a very, very diverse group of individuals with a lot of different ideas that bump up against one another. One of the concepts that we discussed a little bit earlier in Catholic social teaching was subsidiarity, which seems to be custom made for handling this diversity. You know, I tell my students, I hate it when they use the term the masses because it sounds like everybody has the same preferences. So let's just break that down to individual people who have different preferences, ideas, goals, and they can kind of sort this out themselves at the most local level. And this is kind of where Acton Institute and yourself really champions the idea of markets being able to do this. So do you want to speak to anything about subsidiarity and where maybe Pope Francis swings and misses on that one, or where it could possibly be worked in?
Well, I think it can be worked into, in one sense, it is very much part of the way he thinks about things. And another sense, it's not. He does have this tremendous emphasis upon the need to respect local communities, the need to respect the freedom of different groups. By that, particularly, he means the poor. He's actually quite critical of Western NGOs. NGO is a bad word for him, by the way. It means who go into, say, a rural area or a slum in Buenos Aires and then start telling people how to live their lives. He's very critical of that because he says that these groups, these NGOs, are often ignorant of local wisdom, of local traditions that help to keep some of these societies and communities together and ticking over time in a context where you don't have security property rights and you don't have rule of law. So on one level, he's very respectful of the freedom and autonomy that subsidiarity is supposed to confer upon different groups. But on the other hand, and you alluded to this, when you use this language of the people, or even the masses, or the marginalized, you tend to group them all as one particular group. And it's rarely the case that people who are in any one sort of artificially created group think the same way about things. I mean, I find it interesting, for example, that in Argentina today, some of the people who are voting against the Peronists, who are voting against some of the more populist types of movements, a large number of them are living on the margins of society. Large numbers of people in the last election who live in some of the barrios of Buenos Aires voted for the non-Peronists. So the people, so to speak, clearly have quite different political views and even economic views on things. Many people who are living in the margins of Argentine society want to get out of the margins. They want to move into the middle class. They want to become wealthy. They want to be able to create jobs, to create businesses, to go and work and fulfill different vocations. And when you talk about the people as your reference point, then in some respects, you're implicitly denying that there are different groups on the margins of society with different views about how they want to live their lives and what they want to do. So on the one hand, there's a sense in which Pope Francis is thinking about theology of the people and the way that that plays out in life does affirm a principle of subsidiarity. On the other hand, another aspect of it tends to blur, if not obscure, the importance of recognizing the differences of views among people who are on the margins of society.
Yeah, that's a great way to sum it up, and it actually resonates a lot with recent electoral trends here in the United States and Europe and elsewhere too. So, lots of things to be thinking about. We're running near the end of our time here, and I always like to end with one question for our guest that allows them to reflect upon their own intellectual development over the course of, in your case, a few decades here. Is there anything that has surprised you or has really changed your mind over the course of your intellectual development that in studying this? Anything that pops up to you that says, you know, 20, 25 years ago, I wouldn't have thought this, but now I'm at this place.
Well, in terms of my own intellectual formation, it's a very Catholic formation. I've been very shaped by the natural law tradition. That's more or less the framework that I work out of when it comes to economics, and particularly political economy. But I guess there's two things that would stick out for me. One is that I think political economy is something that I've become much more attentive to as opposed to economics per se. So when I read, for example, Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, it's not just the economic insights that strike me now, things like comparative advantage, things like trade-offs, the problems of mercantilism, et cetera, et cetera. What's become even more striking to me is the political part of all this, that when you dig down, you realize that you can persuade people on the basis of economics that free trade works, but unless you get the political part of political economy right, you are going to have problems persuading people. So to that extent, I think that I've become much more conscious that economics is politically embedded in many respects, and while it's important to recognize that economics as a social science does bring particular insights, it's important to remember that these things operate in a political environment. So when I read Adam Smith now, I read him as a political economist, and I think that you can see the different philosophical and even to a certain extent theological influences that are at work in the background. So that's one thing, this whole thing about political economy. A second thing I think that's become even more apparent to me is that I used to be quite optimistic about the capacity to change people's minds, to help them to see that, look, Keynesianism doesn't really work, that collectivism certainly doesn't work, that you need to have an economic system that reflects certain truths about the human person, that we're free, but we're also sinful, that we're individual and we're social, etc., etc. And maybe it's because I'm now old enough to see that many of these intellectual trends go back and forth, and now I think we're into a stage where the case for markets, the case for free trade, is really on the back foot now. I thought, for example, that the case for free trade was more or less won. I thought that argument was more or less over. Well, I think we're discovering throughout much of the world that that is not the case. And so I think that what this does tell me is that for those like myself who are very interested in advancing the cause of markets and limited government, is that the arguments never end. You have to keep making the arguments to the next generation of people, and if you don't make the arguments, then alternative ideas will take root, and once they take root, they're very, very difficult to dislodge. So that's not a pessimistic view of the world, by the way. I think it's me coming to a realization that the battle for ideas never really stops, that it's a constant struggle in the world of ideas, in the world of politics, in a numerous range of fields. But that can work well as well. So, for example, in the case of Argentina, which we've been talking about, populist ideas are clearly on the back foot now. Why are they on the back foot? Because it's more and more Argentines are realizing that they have to get out of this, that they have to get out of this way of thinking in a populist manner, in a Peronist manner about things. So the battle of ideas on the one level, while in some respects, particularly in America and Western Europe, the case for markets, for free trade is significantly under pressure now, that's not the case in some other countries where the case for markets and for open markets and open trade and the case for limited government, private property and all these good things is actually strengthening. So I guess what that tells us is that the intellectual battle is going to differ a great deal depending upon what country or culture you're living in at any one point in time. The greatest free advocates of free trade today tend to come from developing countries. The most voracious advocates of economic nationalism tend to come from developed countries. You wouldn't think that that would be the case, but I think that's the state we're in now.
Very interesting observations, and as you talked about, the intellectual battle always continues. I think also about the pastoral mission, that the Great Commission is not a destination, but a process that we go through, and it's the same thing with the battle for freedom and for markets as well. Very well put. My guest today has been Samuel Gregg. Sam, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
My pleasure. Great to be with you, Anthony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.